ladies, welcome to the Cicero Quilting Society. Would you be so kind as to come this way?
This is the Extra Hot Great Podcast, episode 4 for the week of September 9th, 2013. I am your Tiger Cub, David T. Cole, and I'm here with Jip Rossetti PTSD survivor, Joe Reed.
Bone Fortuna.
Prosthetic face, Sarah D. Bunting. And Gun Mall, Tar Ariano.
Please enjoy this pornographic drawing.
So, Boardwalk Empire is back. I think a lot of people might have been like me. If you're reading the site, you know that I did a marathon of season 3 to get caught up before the season 4 premiere on Sunday. I had quit season 3 for one reason and one reason only. That is one Jip Rossetti, played by Bobby Cannavale, who I usually like, in a performance that I despised of a character that was completely pointless and slowed time down to a crawl. I feel like my man Joe Reed doesn't disagree, but my brother, Dave Bunting, occasional EHG guest, suggested that things did speed up and that I should just stick with it and it would be worth it and Jip would be killed. Spoiler. Thank God it was true. But watching the show all in a row like that, I really realized that the complaint that people tend to have about the show, which Jip and that the way he was filmed and written and everything really epitomized, was that it just takes its time with things. And some of those things you're going to care about and think are beautifully shot and want to spend more time with. For me, that's Richard Harrow and Chalky and Pernsley and a few other characters. And other things you're just not gonna really get, like Van Alden's whole thing from the beginning, like Michael Shannon, he's really trying, but he's also, you know,
really trying.
Yeah. And you just have to accept the show on that basis and realize, like, whatever's not working for you, you're just gonna have to, you know, make jokes on a website about how boring it is. And now you've just had Social Security checks arrive at your house during whatever speech Jip is giving, and that's that's kind of that. It does have really amazing, beautiful, exciting moments. And the season premiere looked really promising, but it's going to be one of those things, I think, where it's going to be 6 or 7 weeks before anything substantive really starts to happen. And there might not be a lot of payoffs, but I am going to stick with it because I can accept it for what it is. And also, it's complete decor and clothing porn.
Yeah.
And I like that stuff. Joe, are you still sticking with it this year?
Well, I finally extricated myself from having to write about this professionally. And then those bastards went and cast Jeffrey Wright.
Right? I know.
Pulled me right back in because I'm not going to not watch something that Jeffrey Wright's on, particularly on HBO. Although then, once again, as if to mock me personally, me, who hasn't really done anything too bad to them besides say some bad things, he's not even in the first episode. It's just like, you're going to have to wait. And they introduce a lot
characters. It's like late night news. Something Jeffrey Wright says might kill you. Tune in tonight at 11.
Tune in tomorrow. Assholes. And then, like, whatever, like, Nucky's got a new girl on the side, and she's sort of like...
Not anymore.
Whatever. But, like, I feel like that's going to be the thing. It's just sort of like, now, Nucky's plot, I don't care. I don't... They've stopped me from caring about the little sort of, like, political machinations, because it all seems to reset back at zero.
Yes.
At the beginnings of each season. So it's just sort of like, it's like when you said Dave told you that Jip Rossetti got killed by the end of the season. And in my head, I was just like, yeah, well... season-long guest star, and then I was like, oh, right, well, that's going to be Jeffrey Wright this season, where they're going to go through the whole season, and, like, he'll be dispatched by the end, and we'll reset back.
The Ralph Cifaretto or the Richie Aprile, they do have some Sopranos-y habits, and not
very a lot of. You've mentioned those in your articles, and that's really true.
Not particularly good ones, necessarily, either, or it was probably done better the first time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't hold this against Cannavale, but wow. Like, I don't know what else he was supposed to do with that character.
Yeah. And this is also a show, and HBO gets like this with a lot of their stuff sometimes, that gets really overly proud of how envelope pushy it is with like violence and sex. And like, it may be old fashioned, but it's not your grandfather's whatever dom sub Atlantic City,
bootleggers
whatever.
Invented autoerotic asphyxia.
Yeah.
No one cares.
Yeah.
Get on with it.
Yeah. So.
Well, the thing about season three, I think more so, you know, it's true that it resets it, but season three just seemed to be like, you could take season three out of the timeline and everything that happens to season three, you could just pick up from 2 to 4 without too much trouble.
But Dave, Margaret's crusade for contraception
yeah.
is so important.
Which started too late for her and Owen in a box.
The territory rivalries that are going on, you know, the New York camp, the Philly camp, and the, you know, the Atlantic.
Chicago.
Yeah, Chicago and everything. Like, they set all that up for a big war, and they had, like, a couple sort of volleys, you know, with trying to get you know, somebody in federal court and all that stuff, and then it just, like, at the beginning of the season are like, all right, we're good, here's a bag of money, everything's okay. Like, they can't even,
yeah,
they don't know how to build up to something, and they don't know how to have something to build up to, you know. They give you the worst of both worlds, which is they build it up, promise a lot, make that process not terribly exciting, and then not give you the payoff. And
well, they do that thing that long-running, or hopefully long-running, TV shows do, where at the very beginning you know that this is going to boil down to Nucky and Rothstein and Capone.
Mm-hmm.
But they're sort of like flung to the far corners of the country right now. So they spend so much time having to build up and then knock down people like Rossetti, mm-hmm. or Masseria, or whoever that guy from Philly was who got killed. And even Jimmy, although Jimmy was whatever, like, that was a decision they had to make on the fly because Michael Pitt is apparently terrible.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, I understand that you want to go, like, whatever, 6 seasons. But if you set up this very clear sort of march towards conflict between Rothstein and Capone and Nucky, like, you have to get to it.
Well, the other issue, for me at least, is that Rothstein is braided into so many scandals of this era, or sort of big stories of this era, as was Gaston Bullock Means, in fact. And both those portrayals, with apologies to Buscemi, are much more interesting to me. I mean, I'm particularly interested in who Stuhlbarg pissed off in the makeup trailer, because Arnold Rothstein looked like an angry mime. And he wasn't the only one. They're shooting Buscemi, like,
yeah,
through a burlap bag. It's not, I don't know, like, everyone else manages to look great who's a junkie, and then he just looks like he washed up on shore.
Boardwalk Empire is one of those shows where you wish you could just sort of, like, take 8 characters, they don't even have to make sense together, and just pull them out, like Eddie Cantor and Gaston Means, mm-hmm. and, like,
love that guy,
and what is Gretchen Mol's character?
Jillian Darkly.
Just make them sort of, like, throw them into a house together and have them, like, big brother it out for the rest of the summer.
There is a sort of, I think, having grown up in Jersey, there is maybe a meta comment about just the fact that the state is hopelessly corrupt and, you know, plus que change, etc. But I don't think they're doing that intentionally. Like, occasionally someone gets a big speech about how New Jersey is a fourth class citizen and no one cares, and it's like, yes, we get it, armpit Roger. But I mean, Dave is right that I don't think, like, the way they keep resetting it, I think, is not sort of a David Chasey larger comment on the fact that things don't really change in life and about men with power. It's just like, this is what you do with a 12 episode order.
Well, and also when you're dealing, like you said, with people that lived, where it's sort of like, there's only so much
leeway.
Treading water you can do before it's gonna, events are gonna catch up with stuff that, you know, we know happened.
Yeah.
But my problem
and
is
with
what
characters who showed up in The Great Gatsby in modified form, like, call it Rothstein Empire, please, and move the action up a couple of years so we're getting close to when things really happen.
But I agree with
Meyer Lansky, do something for fuck's sake. Like, anyway, Tara, sorry.
I was just going to say, yes, Tara, please go on and agree with me. But I do. For me, the problem with the show is that the canvas is too big. Like, maybe I'm dumb, but I have a hard time following, like, who's mad at who at any given moment. And it's like, this is the problem with a lot of shows that have a large ensemble cast, where it's like, you can't care equally about everybody.
Well, it kind of ties into what I was saying. They have sort of have an epic setup, but no follow through.
Yes, exactly. And when you compare it to the other organized crime show that's in the same time slot, which is Breaking Bad, like you can, it's something with a much smaller scope can be that much more satisfying because, like, yeah, you know those characters, you understand their motivations, you feel suspense when they're making big, momentous decisions, whereas it's like, I don't know what Chalky White is going to do about anything. Like, you know, I like the character, but it's like, it's hard to have any investment in him because, you know, you see him for 5 minutes at a time or 5 minutes in an episode even. Yeah. And where is Margaret? Did she die in the last season? I don't even remember.
She went to Brooklyn to have an abortion.
Oh, right.
Which she may or may not have actually gone through with, but she's probably still in Brooklyn. So,
right.
Well, something happened because there was blood. So maybe they gave her some herbal Brooklyn batch abortive
artisanal.
Well, and he referred to himself, Nucky said he's single, so I guess whatever happened.
Oh, yeah. Yes, he is a bachelor.
Yes.
But he always acts like he's a bachelor, so who knows?
Of course.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, calling her Billy Jr. in your particle yesterday, Sarah, was perfect because who I didn't care about Billy and I don't care about this one either.
Yeah, and I'm glad this one was dispatched more quickly than Billy, who, you know, no offense to Meg Steedle, but that character, that was another one that it's like, you're going to get killed so we can take it personally.
Right.
Right.
Exclamation point.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah, I thought she actually did a pretty good job with that character, but there was just no...
She was fine, but who cares?
Right.
Yeah.
And every time I saw her, I was like, well, she's a good actor, but she got cast because she looks like the 1920s, like that face.
Yes.
Such a period
And also she is a Broadway musical.
Right.
I mean, she came, a lot of people that you're like, who the hell? And then you go on the IMDb and it's all like,
Yeah.
Such Theater and Steppenwolf and whatever. Yeah. And also We'll Take Off Top.
Right.
Because,
let's
face it, if you're not going to show some titty, you're not getting on the show.
Yes. The struggles these casting directors must go through to find women with natural boobs.
Yeah.
So, like, any parting thoughts on, like, some bandage or big idea fixes for this show?
I mean, I would love to think that summit at the beginning meant that at least some of those players were going to be not part of it anymore. Mm-hmm. So it's like, just focus on a few things that we can sink our teeth into.
Yeah, and I think if they focus, then that can drive one or two big storylines and then actually drive to something rather than, you know, feeling like they have to juggle all these things in the air and never really pay off on any one of them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, do you know anyone who super duper loves this show?
No.
I feel like everybody who watches it kind of grudgingly.
Well, it has all the trappings of a show that I really enjoy between the setting and, you know, the production values and the, you know, the idea of, you know, the mob in the 20s is interesting. But I want this show to infuse itself with, like, Untouchables DNA.
Yeah, yes.
You know, it needs more of that. It needs more of actual stuff happening. It needs characters that drive the story instead of all the characters just sort of being mopey and not ambitious, a lot of them, where they should be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, even Al Capone, who, you know, as we know from history, you know, was a very ambitious man, is watered down still in the storyline. And I get he's sort of Al Capone, you know, light still at this point.
Right.
In training, yeah.
Yeah, but that's all disappointing. This, you know, it still doesn't really add up to a compelling appointment television experience.
Yeah.
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 He doesn't like you, he's grumpy as can be. He doesn't like fun, that's plain to see. Time to ask, will Dave hate this?
Probably.
We're reviving Will Dave Hate This segment for a very exciting entrant, which is HBO's upcoming Westworld TV series, which will involve the behind-the-scenes talents of one Jonathan Nolan, brother of Christopher, and one J.J. Abrams of everything.
Yeah.
And the debate is whether Dave will hate this show, because I understand the original Westworld movie with Yul Brynner.
Sure.
Is
androids run amok.
Yeah, as everything in a fake Western theme park.
Which, let's just backtrack for a second.
Go ahead.
Western theme parks really just fell off a cliff in the 70s.
Yeah, they did.
Like, I remember, like, Joe, do you remember Fantasy Island in your neck of the woods?
I do remember Fantasy Island,
fondly. Remember they had a thoroughfare there, and every couple
Old
hours.
West show, yeah.
Yeah, every couple hours, they would have, like, a gun shooting, rooting, tooting fight out in the main thoroughfare. Bang, bang, bang. Guys would fall off the roofs of the saloon and all this crazy stuff was happening. Mm-hmm. And then nothing.
Yeah.
Westerns ended. Anyways.
Leaving aside the weirdness of casting Yul Brynner.
I'm just saying, in the future, I doubt there's Western theme parks. So that's the first thing they're going to have to change to win me over.
Well, so I'm going to say, based on not even that, that Dave will hate this, mostly because... Not just nostalgia. You have not. I know from experience you have not liked a lot of the remakes that have come down the pike of things that you've liked. You didn't care for the Total Recall remake. Mm-hmm. You have zero interest in the RoboCop remake, I believe.
Yes, that is true. That looks terrible.
And you have been burned by just about every J.J. Abrams show you've watched, even Alias. Although that
I like Alias,
not at the end.
Oh no, sure.
It fell off a cliff.
Sure.
So for all those
fell off
reasons,
a couple cliffs.
Yeah, and you're not crazy
fell
about
off the cliff Homer Simpson style,
right? But yeah. you don't love Christopher Nolan's Batman movies either. So the like the genre
I don't hate
crossover.
Them, though. Let's just get that clear.
Okay, I didn't say you hated them. Passable. I said you don't like them.
Yeah,
you grudgingly watch those too.
This is like a B plus affair for me.
Okay,
yeah.
So, but mostly for the J.J. Abrams factor.
The Winter Sun.
I would say those are my reasons for why you'll hate it.
Okay.
Sarah, I believe you said you concur.
Yes, I concur that Dave will hate this. I think that Dave's I don't know why I think this, but I feel like Dave's standards for Western simulacra, even if they're obviously, you know, supposed to be a theme park.
Excuse me, I have to get my dictionary.
please write me a check for 50 cents. Thank you.
That'd make a great villain
I feel
name.
Like his standards for
the
that.
The mighty simulacra.
Just, yeah, your mom's a simulacra. I think that he's going to end up nitpicking that. I don't know why. I think that, and I also think that the things that he doesn't like about Nolan and Batman are going to be, like, squared in this. There's also the Abrams factor. I just think he's going to... It's going to diverge from what he's expecting in a way that is no bueno, and he will hate it.
It's also the genre crossover aspect of, like, it's cowboy crossed with sci-fi.
Well, we don't know if it's still going to be a cowboy thing.
You're right.
Yeah.
Although it's called Westworld.
That's true.
Joe.
All right. Here's what I'm going to say.
Here we go.
Dave's a smart man.
Thanks, Joe.
Dave's a really good guy. Dave is not a quitter. Dave wouldn't just look at this thing and just be like, oh, this thing that I, that this concept that's really appealing to me. Oh, wait, it's J.J. Abrams? I quit. I don't have the fortitude to even try this. Dave's not like that. B, the Western future robot thing. Not going to be as winky as it was on Firefly, so that's pretty good. Lens flares will once again make sense in this futuristic Western because there's a lot of sunshine in Westerns. And won't be like stupid Star Trek where the lens flares made no sense. Dave is smart enough to know that a show like, say, Lost didn't fail and fall apart because of J.J. Abrams because he wasn't really involved with that show much beyond season one, despite the fact that its reputation on the outer internet tends to loop J.J. Abrams into that when it's probably not his fault. Dave is also not so precious about the sanctity of remakes that he wouldn't think that HBO would do a better job at remaking some classic material than, say, the Total Recall remake on the cheap did. And I think ultimately...
Well, he did love Mildred Pierce. Just kidding.
Dave, yeah, see? No. Point in my favor.
He didn't.
I think ultimately it's just going to be that the concept of Westworld is too good to pass up, at least giving it a shot.
Here's the clincher for Westworld. It is a remake about, you know, androids that sort of, you know, decide that, you know, they've had it up to here with all this. So we're either looking at something good like early Battlestar Galactica or something really painful and drawn out like Caprica. So, knowing that J.J. Abrams is producing this, his TV stuff, for me, has generally struck out when he's not when they don't apply J.J. Abrams directly to the forehead, such as Alias, right? When he's just you know, in the background and making some high-level decisions about it, such as Lost and stuff like that. Although Lost, I blame more on the writers than, you know, J.J. Abrams. As Joe pointed out, I think J.J. Abrams gets a bad rap when it comes to Lost. I think that this show is going to hinge on that ability to update, which basically is one of those very 70s things. Like, we got the Logan's Run remake coming out, we got Westworld. I think there is a lot of excellent writing opportunities here, and the fact that HBO is making it, and the fact that we're going to have a limited number of episodes per season, like, what are we talking, 10 or 12 usually?
It's usually
12.
Yeah,
something 10 like
or that. Well, 13 is standard
cable. Okay, all right, so yeah. 13 episodes. So I don't think they're going to bite off a lot per season. So I don't think our storylines are going to get too stupid too fast with Westworld. But the question is, are they going to treat it smart? Are they going to treat it dumb? I mean, it has a potential to be sort of like some episodes of Black Mirror, I think, where it's going to be a comment on the information age. Let's put aside the Boardwalk Empire discussion we just had, where the writing goes nowhere.
Yes.
If they can make it go somewhere, I'm going to guess I will not hate this.
Yeah.
Why don't you just marry Joe?
Maybe I
seriously
will.
Great.
Going from one topic to another, an appropriate segue makes it smooth as butter.
So with the return of the Brenda years to SoapNet's run of Beverly Hills 90210, which as of this recording came back today, Sarah and I wanted to have a discussion that we've been having offline basically almost as long as we've known each other, which is, who is more terrible, Dylan McKay or Brandon Walsh?
I have my answer.
Sarah, why don't you go
first? I don't
know
if I do. I think I might need you two to
sell
me.
This is easy, Joe. This is an easy one, but let's let the experts weigh in first.
Make the case against Dylan.
Against Dylan?
Yes.
Oh, you mean for Dylan as the
as
worst?
The worst.
Oh,
yes,
gladly.
I'm sorry. Yes, the case against Dylan as a person and or character.
Let us begin with the baseball outfit.
Okay, I can't argue
that. You once described him as looking like a stick insect wearing the baseball pants. That has never left me. As much mirth as that has given me, his attire is a consistent problem. The sleeveless Baja top in particular fills me with pure white hot rage. I see also the huge trench coat of paternal mourning.
I believe it's a duster, actually.
Oh, excuse me, duster. It looked kind of school shooty. The comforting of his inner child, who was an even worse actor than Luke Perry was at that time in his career. Sorry, Luke Perry, not trying to conflate the two of you. His fondness for Byron, his whole being pissy about the SATs and picking fights with people about that, like, just follow the rules and take the SATs like everyone else. You're not that special. His affected anti-establishment stance and rudeness to Jim Walsh. The fact that he was worse at delivering jokes than anyone else in the main cast, and they didn't fit with his character. Huge hair,
huge
attitude
forehead
problem, 22, yes, 12 head, 22 inch waist, and that whole side plot that he got with that horseback riding lady named Anne, who was maybe the only person more punchable than him. case closed. Oh, didn't he become a junkie also?
Sure did.
Yes,
and
yes,
don't name
did
a cat Trouble. It's Smurfy. I am done. Make the case for Brandon.
All right. Dylan at least demonstrated he had the capacity to be in a relationship with someone. Brandon, through his entire high school time, only managed to date someone longer than a week or two twice. One was an actual crazy person, Emily Valentine. The other was Nikki, who was a freshman when he was a senior, which is gross. And also, she had an ex-boyfriend named Diesel, who was played.
And she dated David.
Yes, she did. Or was it Diesel or Weasel? It was something. Anyway, it was David Arquette.
I think it was David Arquette, so yeah.
Brandon called him Weasel, and it was definitely David Arquette, and he had a keytar. Continue.
I can't argue any of the superficial points that you brought up about Dylan's dress or manner. However, Brandon is clearly a worse person, and I will say this as, and he, the other thing is he got away with so much shit because he was always, compared to Brenda, who's the biggest bitch on the show, maybe in all of television before or since, but he was a bitch also, and he would practically not get through any episode
a bitch
without
with a job, just saying.
True, where he would bitch people out at work, including his boss. In that horrible Brandon braying voice where he's, come on, man, like, I can't even do it. It's so, so bad. Running for student council, thinking he's the shit. Walking that way that he walks.
Oh, I know the way.
The enormous watches.
The 14-inch way, yeah.
Getting on the goddamn task force, not letting anyone forget it. I mean, he's just so obnoxious.
As and much what as- force? It was just him. That's not a force. Right. And what task? You know what? I changed my mind. You're totally right. Also, he's completely a Republican. Here's the thing. He is a legit worse person, but Dylan is just more annoying to me. And at least Brandon, when he left, stayed gone.
Yeah. Point. All right.
Brandon Walsh is like the poster child for the term little shit.
Yeah, he is.
Yeah.
He's so far and away the worst of these two characters.
So little and so shitty.
Here's what I think breaks the tie for me is that the show at least would often acknowledge what a pill Dylan was to deal with.
Yes.
And it always, always, always lionized Brandon.
Yeah.
Which makes Brandon worse.
Brandon was the hero. Brandon's awful.
Right, and Brandon comes off all the worse for being force-fed to us as the hero. So yeah, Brandon's worse.
I mean, almost one of the very first things that we see in season one is Brandon's crazy girlfriend from Minnesota runs away and comes to the house, and they have sex for the first time. And at the end of it, Jim is like, my boy fucking! Like, he just thinks it's the greatest thing ever. I'm paraphrasing. There's no blowback for Brandon on this. Whereas anytime...
Way to go, boy. Here's a dollar.
Anytime Brenda, like, fucking holds hands with Dylan, Jim is down her throat, making sure that her pants are closed.
Yeah,
like,
because it's Dylan, and you should not be fucking somebody who cannot fit... Who, like, you can't fit into his jeans. I think that's a good rule.
I don't think you should do that.
And
who
comes into your office and like puts his feet up on your desk and is like, I'm going to give you attitude about my trust fund. And Jim manages not to punch him in the face, for which he should get a fucking parade. Fuck off, Dylan.
You changed your mind,
man. It's the best.
Wow. All right, it's time for the canon. And Joe is presenting this week. Take it away, Joe.
I am. And my presentation is fairly... extensive, so I'm not going to get into too much preamble. It's 6 Feet Under. It's the pilot episode of 6 Feet Under. You all know what 6 Feet Under is. Family-run funeral home. HBO premiered while Sopranos was taking one of their weird 14-month sojourns or whatever. So as we begin, I just want to get it out of the way. How depressing is LA at Christmas? Super, super, super depressing, as we see like right in the opening minutes of this, where it's like Christmas music, but it's all snowless and awful. Anyway... So much of this pilot is taking idyllic setups like the holidays or the family business and making you look at the roiling human business going on underneath. So the first thing we see, Nathaniel Fisher, played by Richard Jenkins, future Oscar nominee Richard Jenkins, takes the gleaming brand new hearse out to pick up his son Nate from the airport, singing I'll Be Home for Christmas and sneaking a cigarette behind his wife's back, which is when Nathaniel gets blindsided by a bus at the intersection and is killed instantly. Back at home, his son David Fisher is managing the Florida wake for a woman whose husband is, let's say, taking the long view on his wife's demise.
You've done a nice job. She looks so peaceful.
Well, she is at peace now.
If there's any justice in the universe, she's shoveling shit in hell.
You'll see this a lot in both this episode and the series as a whole, where the platitudes and the scriptedness of our funereal rituals are made to look absurd when contrasted with the ugly, complicated people that are actually doing the grieving. Alan Ball gets a little enamored with the ugly part at times, but he gets to the heart of that contrast of how we cover up our moments of extreme despair with strict protocol. Case in point, when Ruth Fisher, Nathaniel's wife, gets the phone call that her husband's been killed and makes a big old scene upstairs while David's trying to keep things calm at the wake.
Hello. This is Ruth Fisher. Yes, I'm his wife. What is this about? What?
Excuse me.
That was Ruth throwing everything off of the counters of everywhere, including the pot roast off of the oven.
Mom, what the hell are you...
There's been an accident. The new hearse is totaled. Your father is dead. Your father is dead, and my pot roast is ruined.
Meanwhile, the youngest Fisher, Claire, is still in high school and hanging with her high school friends, a bunch of total burnout stoners, including Gabe, played by Eric Balfour, at the absolute peak of his sorry not sorry, but Joe totally would phase. Gabe encourages Claire to try crystal meth with the ironclad endorsement that it is not, in fact, crack. Claire has no sooner exhaled than she gets a call from David with the news about her dad, leading to my single favorite scene in the episode and what probably sold me on the show, not to mention Lauren Ambrose, for good.
I have to go.
No fucking way.
Excuse me.
Wait. Hey. You're going back, right?
I don't think so. My dad just got hit by a bus, and it broke his neck, and he's dead. I gotta go pick up my mom and bring her to the morgue so she can identify his body. No, I'm not kidding. This is actually happening. And now I'm high on crack.
Crystal.
What up? So I guess this whole hellish experience I'm about to go through is just gonna burn a little brighter now, right? Right!
The eldest Fisher, Nate, is flying in from Seattle, which is where he ended up after fleeing the family home as soon as it was legally possible. We see him have anonymous airport sex with a woman from his flight, but when he gets the call about his dad while still pantsless in the janitor's closet, this nameless woman becomes his ride home, so to speak. On the way, battling through a surprising amount of Rachel Griffith's ADR dialogue, Nate tells Brenda about his family and she hers.
My dad really rode my ass when I was a kid. Couldn't go rafting because he just buried this girl who drowned. Buries this dipshit loser who OD'd at a Flock of Seagulls concert. And suddenly I'm not allowed to go to concerts for a year.
Your dad worked in a cemetery?
How could a man who's so fucking scared of everything, who never had an accident or even a speeding ticket in his entire fucking life, how could he have a car wreck?
Are you mad at him or the fact that we're all gonna die?
Are you a shrink?
No, God, no, no. Both my parents are.
Once the whole family is reunited, their myriad dysfunctions and resentments become aggressively clear. Nate left home early enough that he barely ever got to know Claire, so his push-pull of lecturing her without providing actual guidance to his poor tweaking sister is met by a series of short-tempered teenage surliness on her end. Ruth's battiness has an edge of danger to it, like she might actually be unhinged. And David and Nate compete for her favor, but in a way that never seems to actually involve engaging with her for too long. The brothers' rivalry is predictable, perhaps, but true, and the interplay between Peter Krause and Michael C. Hall is instantly one of the show's strengths.
Nice going, Dave. Make sure she doesn't have enough to feel bad about right now?
Things have to be done. Federico's downstairs ready to start. Every second we wait will only make Dad's restoration more difficult. But you wouldn't know about that, would you? Bag boy.
Bag boy? I am assistant manager of organic produce at the highest volume food co-op in Seattle.
Jesus! Pull your dicks out and measure them. Let's get this over with.
There are practical concerns, of course. There is now a funeral to be planned for on Christmas Day, no less. We don't see a ton of Freddy Rodriguez as mortuary assistant Rico in this pilot, but the small bits of him taking an enthusiastic pride in his work are darkly funny. Plus, the part at the burial where Ruth compliments his porcelain doll hands is fairly priceless. Mostly, it's David who takes on the task of burying his father, going by the book in a way that frustrates the crunchier Nate. The thing is, for as buttoned up as David is, he's the one holding down a secret life with a secret boyfriend, hot cop Keith, who catches Claire's eye at the wake just before she spots him and her closeted brother in a moment. And for all of Nate's Whole Foods-y Seattle-ness, he's as angry and as unfulfilled as any stereotypical establishment dad. The subversion of tropes in the hands of excellent actors makes for some excitingly open-ended characters. Ruth's revelation that she had been having an ongoing affair with a hairdresser isn't quite so subversive, but Ruth's deepening happens later on in the first season. The mundanity of the funeral business is juiced by frequent flights of fancy in this episode, from the fake commercials selling funeral parlor accoutrements in the style of Egoist perfume ads, to momentary hallucinations. Each of the surviving Fishers sees an apparition of the late Nathaniel at least once, always reflecting their own personal neuroses, Nate's lifelong fear of death, for example.
Well, well. The prodigal returns. This is what you've been running away from your whole life, buddy boy. Scared the crap out of you when you were growing up, didn't it? And you thought you'd escape. Well, guess what? Oh, nobody escapes.
Everything comes to a head at the burial, particularly for Nate and David. Nate drama queens about how David's hermetically sealed approach to bereavement is suffocating them all, and he refuses to conform, man.
No! I refuse to sanitize this anymore.
This is how it's done.
Yeah? Well, it's whacked. What is this stupid salt shaker? Huh? What is this hermetically sealed box, this phony astroturf around the grave? Jesus, David, it's like surgery. Clean, antiseptic, business. He was our father.
Please don't do this.
You can pump him full of chemicals, you can put makeup on him, and you can prop him up for a nap in the slumber room, but the fact remains, David, that the only father we're ever going to have is gone. Forever. And that sucks. But it's a goddamn part of life, and you can't really accept it without getting your hands dirty. Well, I do accept it, and I intend to honor the old bastard by letting the whole world see just how fucked up and shitty I feel that he's dead. God damn it!
I'm as prone to a shut-up Nate as the next guy, and as the series would go on, I'd be even more so. But what works about this episode is that after Nate delivers his speech and nearly stomps off, Ruth steps up and puts Nate's theoretical rant into practice. Her grief is intense and ugly and perhaps just as cathartic as Nate says. Afterwards, David also gets his chance to articulate his position to Nate, though the dialogue is smart and shocking enough. I'm thinking right now of David mentioning sticking formaldehyde-soaked cotton up his dead father's ass, that nothing feels like debate class. At episode's end, you've got two brothers poised to butt heads over the family business and a family that has no real idea how to be around each other, now huddled closer in grief. So that's the pilot, 6 feet under. What do you guys think?
Well, here's the thing about Alan Ball. Well, there are some things about Alan Ball. That last clip, I think, is it like encapsulates the series because the complete and utter sanctimony, not only of Nate, but of kind of the show in that moment that is put over by really excellent acting, that's, I think, a trademark of the show. Mm-hmm. There are some, like all the tactless comments here and through the series that Alan Ball has Ruth or other people make, random non sequiturs. These are like little observations that he's clearly been saving up for years on end. Like the porcelain hands thing is like, it's a nice bit of writing, but it's not really how people talk, not even Ruth. You can tell he's been holding on to it for a while. But then Frances Conroy really sells it, and she sells everything else that she's been given to do. I think her initial characterization is pretty cheaply done. But she's so committed from the get that, especially in her confession scene where she's talking about having the affair, that it's just so flawlessly timed and acted that you end up buying it. And I think that's really true. I think that's part of what sucked me in to the series was this premise that was pretty outre, but the actors made it work. Like, Michael C. Hall is not given that much quiet to do in the pilot, but he's already so good.
Yeah.
When he's given something subtle and just little, the little things that sort of leak out around the sides of the, his buttoned upness. But yeah, I mean, a lot of it is very on the nose, but then Alan Ball sometimes connects with something really directly, and there's some flash forwards to, spoiler, Nate's eventual death and David's reaction to that towards the end of the series, that was one of the most intense hours of TV for me. And it's all kind of collapsed down into this moment. The acting is fantastic. I forgot how enjoyable Lauren Ambrose was. I feel like I don't see her in a lot of stuff.
Yeah, not enough.
Yeah, I don't think I'd seen a single frame of 6 Feet Under again since that ringing finale. And it was nice to sort of go back and see where it all started. West Coast?
I was struck this time because I probably have seen this again since it aired, but not for a long, long time. And I also was struck by how fearlessly Peter Krause commits to the character that we will come to know as kind of a prick. And I think it took me a while to figure out in the first run of the series or my watching of it that the show was not necessarily endorsing Nate or how he is. Like, it's just he is that character. We're not supposed to necessarily think he's a hero. And boy, the scene where he starts scooping up dirt at the funeral is so Nate. Good and bad. I mean, it's like,
yeah.
He is that guy. Like, we get that guy. Even more so than when he says he's the assistant manager of produce at Seattle's largest food co-op.
Which is so great. And I'd forgotten that entirely, that line. It's so funny.
Yeah. He's the assistant manager. Yeah. That's really what makes it
perfect.
Yeah. But when he comes home, like, that's such a classic story of, like, the brother who stays and the brother who went. And
yeah.
And they have this the exchange later where, you know, David says, you got to leave and I'll never get to go to law school or whatever now. I forget if he says that in a memory to his father or whatever. You know the scene I'm talking about where he's like, you got to leave and I had to stay. It's like, and Nate says, don't blame me if you're not leading the life that you wanted to lead. Like, they're both wrong and they're both right, you know?
Exactly. And I really like that.
Yeah. And I think the show handles it well. But I wish Alan Ball had more confidence in what he does well, because the subtle moments are so good. As Sarah said, the acting is flawless across the board. But, like, my favorite moment in the whole episode is when Brenda goes into the fridge and gets the olives. And Billy comes in behind her in
already
his dumb
crying.
Christmas sweater, just sobbing.
Already crying.
Oh, my
Brilliant.
God. It's fucking hilarious. Like, she's already established.
Does he even have any dialogue?
He just cries.
Oh,
he opens the door in the fridge and
so
is like,
oh.
And she says, are you looking for the olives? And gives them to him. And he takes the whole thing and leaves. Like, it's perfect. It tells us everything about those two characters. It's hilarious, but in such an understated way. And the fact that it's followed immediately by one of those weird interstitial dumb ads, which Dave, I know, was going to talk about, is like, it undercuts the moment so much. And I'm glad that he finally calmed down with the writing and was just like, trusted it to do the work that it can do when it's done well.
Yeah.
Cause I felt like overall the pilot was pretty overwritten, but it made me rewatching it. It made me want to like continue on with the series again.
Do we remember how long those fake ads would go on for?
I think
was it
just
the first
season? Just in the
pilot. Just in the pilot?
Just the pilot.
Yeah.
Yeah, I forgot those were in there. And Tara, you just said that you felt the pilot was overwritten. It was also over-crammed.
Yeah.
There's too much in this episode, and I realized that it is a pilot, and obviously it suffers from pilotitis like every other pilot. But those commercials should have been the first thing on the cutting floor.
I think they were.
Yeah,
I think they maybe lasted another episode.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Series-wise, they definitely were the first thing from the pilot to be cut, and for good reason. They're not very funny. They even, like, stall the show, literally. Like, they actually, commercials turn themselves off.
Well, and they get worse as it continues. Like, the first one is sort of like, oh, okay, that might be the sort of thing. Like, not that there are TV ads for hearses, but it's like the
trade show video or something.
Each one is more ridiculous than the last. Yeah. And by the time they get to like the Gap ripoff one with to shake your booty for the dirt shakers, it's like, all right.
Yeah.
Like, and it was so self-consciously
it's not quote, quite
outrageous,
enough.
Unquote. Yeah. It's like, just relax. It's a good show. Sarah, you don't need to cram this shit in there.
When Sarah was saying earlier that it felt like Alan Ball had some post-it notes on good lines ideas he had, it seemed to be one of them.
Yes.
And it just wasn't very, very good. And it, you know, would have been a stronger pilot if they were out of there. You know, there are lots of good things in this episode for sure. Joe, you were saying, you know, how it really kind of nails a lot of people's reaction to terrible news, which is, you know, standing on stoic, you know, ceremony and sort of having very, like when Lauren Ambrose's character reacts to the news when she's given the call, she's like, oh, okay, well, you know, thanks for the call, basically, is kind of her thing. She doesn't have a breakdown on the phone. She's all sort of, well, that just happened. And that's sort of the reaction that I had too when I got bad news like that. So that felt really true to me, and I felt that was a good piece of writing to put in, because the easy thing to do for a show like this is to make everybody, you know, run around and wail and be very actorly about it. So I thought that was a good quiet moment that rang really true. And Joe, you're saying how Christmas in LA is really depressing.
It just seems so. It's more depressing for people. I speak without experience, but
people that live here don't care. But I think people that are imported from snowy regions find it a little weird, at least to start. I know I did.
Yeah.
My first year here, I was renting out a room in an apartment with this weird guy. And he had left for Christmas to go wherever, and I couldn't afford a ticket back to Canada. So I was basically in this terrible apartment. This guy had this like taste in furniture, and everything was either chrome or black and red leather. It was like something from a Kraftwerk album come
Patrick
to life.
Patrick Nagel, prints on
the walls and stuff like that. So that was my, and I forgot to like rent a video or something the night before. So everything was closed. So I had to like rummage through his collection, which I found was 95% porn and 1% Rumble in the Bronx with Jackie Chan. So that's how I spent my first Christmas in LA, watching Rumble in the Bronx. So it can be a depressing time of year. But
Benny married me, and every year since then has been
I treasure
it's been
every
Holly
moment.
And Ivy.
Married Aww. Christmas Jones. Now every year, every day is Christmas in our house.
I really loved Jenkins in this pilot.
Yeah,
he's so good.
He's so good, and it made me sad that, you know, the catalyst for all this was his death, because I really, you know, I can't imagine what the show would be where he lives and everything. You know, they explore the same themes with him in it, but I kind of would like to see that alternate reality universe, because he is so good in it. He's my favorite part of this pilot for sure. I think.
Have you seen The Visitor, Dave?
Yeah, we've seen that.
Oh, where he's the bongo playing park guy who has the kind of the midlife crisis / awakening. Yeah.
Yeah,
he's good. He's a really good actor, obviously. I just sort of like, I want to see more to him. I forgot how funny this show could be. You know, like I was saying to Joe, and we had Joe told me to save it for a podcast, so I am. But I forgot that this show is quite funny at times. The Billy scene was really good.
Yeah.
And there's other moments, a lot of them with the dad, that are laugh out loud funny. And I was trying to think, why did I not remember this show was actually had that tone to it? And it's because of that fucking van episode. That
was the last one Dave saw.
Van episode, I was out. I'm like, nope, not happening. And that was 6 feet under for me until I reviewed this pilot again. That was like, for me, that was 6 feet under. It's like, oh yeah, that show with a van and that whole storyline. And oh, it's so serious. And
it did start to take itself more and more seriously as the time went on, and especially with Brenda and Billy.
Well, it got determined to punish its characters.
Yeah.
Yes.
In ways that felt aggressive.
Yeah. And
unless it was Nate, then it was fine.
And I thought they injected the right amount of comedy into the pilot, and it felt good. You know, the moods, the swings could be a little abrupt in the pilot. Not only the ads, but there was a couple of moments when it went not just from funny to sad, but funny to earnest. And I felt like right near the end with, you know, Nate's, bus sequence.
Yes.
There's a beat before that was like a comedy moment, and it kind of transitioned really too quickly into that moment for me. But these are all, so, you know, I'll grade it on the pilot curve and say this is a really strong pilot, with the big misstep for me being the ads. I thought that was tone deaf. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So is everybody ready to put this to a vote?
Yes.
Okay. This is,
I think so.
Okay. Tara.
Yay.
Sarah.
Yay.
And I'm going to say yes too. So.
All right.
3 for 3. 6 feet under, the pilot. You are hereby inducted into the extra hot great canon.
Americans love a winner.
Yeah.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
It's time for winner and loser of the week. And Tara, you have our winner. It's
kind of a surprising winner for me. Mm-hmm. It's Betty White.
Say.
What?
What?
Betty White last week became the Guinness Book of World Records record holder for longest career in television, Lady Division.
Whoa.
There's some other guy who's had a longer career than
Coronation
her.
Coronation Street guy?
I can't remember. It doesn't matter. Who cares?
Yeah.
No one knows who he is. Even I don't.
I bet it's a Coronation Street guy.
Could be.
Yeah.
It's Kenneth Parcell, you guys. He's 700 years old.
Nice. So, you know, she's not my cup of anything, frankly, but I can't
argue. Cup of Earl Grey tea?
Yeah. But I can't. She's not my cup of cheesecake, but I can't argue with the numbers. So congratulations to Betty White. Enjoy holding this honor for as long as you live.
You win again, math.
Yep.
And our loser of the week.
Loser of the week is going to be Katherine Heigl. Wait for it. Haters.
Oh!
Katherine Heigl. Haters.
Twist.
Because... actually, it may be Katherine Heigl haters are the secret winners, because they're going to have Katherine Heigl to kick around again. It seems NBC is interested in a new pilot with her as a CIA agent, of course, working in the White House. Double, of course. I've always been sort of reflexively pro-Heigl. For as vocal as the haters get, I kind of get defensive over her for complicated and perhaps unknown to me reasons. I think TV is the right place for her. I think better than romantic comedies that are all terrible. So I am hoping for the show to do well. I don't think it will, because it's an NBC show about the CIA and the White House. But
is she making out with a ghost in it?
No, not as far as I know. So
I'm out.
Ultimately, it gets a little better than her last Grey's Anatomy work. So,
well, if I'm not going to watch...
Katherine Heigl haters, enjoy.
What's her character in this? What's her occupation?
She's a CIA agent
who is... it sounds like she's an advisor to the president in the White House, sort of like Mary McCormick was in the West Wing in those later years.
Right.
All right. So if you don't like lady CIA agents in Homeland or Covert Affairs, maybe this will be the show for you.
I got a name for it. White House Gown.
Oh.
Listen to this guy, NBC. He knows what he's talking about.
Do you know what time it is?
Game time.
Wow. Okay, everybody. This is the fourth game time of the season. Joe has 2 points. Sarah has 0 still. But I feel good about your chances today, Sarah. I'm feeling that you're going to get on the board. And Tara has 1 point.
That makes one of us.
Okay.
Today we are playing It's Hot Potato, with questions from our good friend Katie. Thank you, Katie, who earns herself an extra credit redeemable for extra hot great mini topic of her choosing. I think we know how to play this game, but just in case you're new to the podcast, in this game, I will read you a category. All right, you three a category. You're going to take turns naming things from said category. For example, if I said TV shows whose theme lyrics explain the concept of the show, you may say...
Clone High,
or Gilligan's Island, or The Brady Bunch. Mm-hmm. These are... you take turns. Yep. We're going to start with Sarah. If Sarah answers, it goes to Joe. If Joe answers, it goes to Tara. Keeps on going in the loop until somebody either guesses incorrectly or cannot guess anything. They are out, and then it's between the last two people. And we do that again, and we have a single person standing, and they get the point, right?
Yes.
Pretty easy. All right. We have five categories. I'd like to remind everybody that the questions are in no particular order. Each week, we pick the player who goes first randomly, thanks to Picky 3000, our incredibly annoying computer picker guy. And this week, as I said, Sarah is going first, then we'll go to Joe, then we'll go to Tara. Are we ready?
Ready.
Ready.
The category is TV shows on which the character of Detective John Munch has appeared.
Oh.
All right. Homicide, Life on the Street.
Law and Order, Special Victims Unit.
Mad About You?
Oh.
I knew he was in... Okay, I'm not saying anything.
Is it me?
Yep. Yeah.
Law and Order, Mothership.
I want to see The Simpsons.
Oh, Sarah. Right.
Sarah gets the point.
Sarah gets a point.
Other shows that he has appeared in, the character has appeared in, 30 Rock on the TiVo-esque thing.
Yes.
Arrested Development.
Right.
He's been Detective Munch on Jimmy Kimmel Live.
Right.
And let's see, Trial by Jury.
Right.
Law and Order.
Oh, of course.
Criminal right. Intent, probably. Yeah. Did someone say that? Going on. What's the rest?
Law and Order, the cartoon.
Right.
Sesame Street. He was a puppet on Sesame Street. He was on a UPN show called The Beat and The Wire and The X-Files. Okay, our second category is members of the Five Timers Club on Saturday Night Live. These are people that have hosted Saturday Night Live five or more times. Sarah got the point, so we'll start with Joe.
Alec Baldwin.
Chevy Chase.
Tom Hanks.
John Goodman.
Drew Barrymore.
Timberlake? What?
Affleck. Ben Affleck.
Has someone said Paul Simon already?
Nope.
Well, shit.
Apparently Paul Simon is an asterisk case of some sort, but he is considered a five-timer.
Yeah.
Generally.
Oh, yeah, because I think he used to be a writer on it.
Or something.
Or he was on original staff somehow.
I'm not sure.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. I think I'm out. So Rudy Giuliani. There it is.
Steve Martin.
Candace Bergen.
Let me just count how many are left. One, two, three, four, five. Five timers left.
Martin Joe. Short?
He was
really?
In that sketch. He was in the latest sketch with Justin Timberlake. That's what I was thinking of him too. But I think the joke was he was not in it. He was a waiter or something.
Aykroyd?
Ones you missed. Nope, not Aykroyd. Bill Murray.
Right. Yeah.
Buck Henry.
Right.
Christopher Walken. Danny DeVito and Elliot Gould.
Danny DeVito?
Yeah.
Ooh,
good lord.
Oh, my Jewish dad.
So, 1 point for Sarah and 1 point for Tara. All right, our third of five categories. And we're starting with Sarah. Members of the State sketch comedy troupe.
Showalter.
Michael Showalter, correct. Joe.
Michael Ian Black.
Correct. Tara.
David Wayne.
Correct.
Damn. My mind is just emptied of actor names. Not Ventresca.
Think of things these people have been in.
Marino.
Ken Marino.
Nice. Kerry Kenny.
Tom Lennon.
That guy with the glasses.
Oh, sure. The guy looks like Axe Cop.
I am out of names. I have only pictures.
Yeah, I have the guy's face in my head, but I don't know what his name is.
I do.
I know you do. I don't know. I'm out.
I read his book, He Magnificent Bastard. I really did. Robert Ben Grant.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tara, do you know any other ones we missed?
I know there's the Kevin's something.
Kevin Allison.
Yeah.
Joe Latrulia.
Sure.
Yeah, right.
And Todd Holabuck.
Yes.
And Robert Ben Grant, you said. Oh, Michael Patrick Jan.
Right.
Yes. All right. Our fourth category is Project Runway finalists brackets shown at Fashion Week. That's what we're looking for. But wait, I'll just let you know. 36 names.
Can question? Wait,
yeah.
Are first names only acceptable?
It's up to y'all. If we can reach consensus, I will accept that. Is that okay with everybody? Joe, Sarah?
Yeah.
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 Okay.
Okay.
I'm just scanning.
So this
everybody
includes winners.
Has...
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Yes. Okay.
And it's people who showed at Fashion Week on TV, not all the decoys or whatever, right?
I cannot answer that with certainty.
Yeah, I think that's got to be true if it's only 36.
Yeah, true.
36,
yeah, right.
Starting with Sarah.
Gretchen Jones.
A little louder, please.
Gretchen Jones.
Joe.
Jay McCarroll.
Michael Knight.
Sarah, is that true? Was Michael Knight?
With a Y.
With a Y.
Oh.
Jeffrey Sebelia.
Bottom. Bottom, bottom, bottom.
Carasan.
Bottom, 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 bottom. Bum, 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 bum.
Corto Mamalu.
Wow.
Wendy Pepper.
I was going to say that one.
I know.
Chloe Dow.
Nice pull. Mondo Guerra.
Victor Luna.
Santino Rice.
Daniel Vasovic.
Back to Sarah.
Leanne.
Yeah, looking. Correct. Cute. Leanne Marshall.
Thank you.
Marshall. Uli something with an H.
Uli something with an H is correct. That is actually her full name. It appears to be Uli Herzer.
Christian Siriano.
Dimitri, guy from last year.
Solikov.
Nice. Oh, fuck. What was that person's name? Oh, god damn it. Now I can't think of it. Jillian. Jillian. Something.
Oh, Michelle.
Correct. Lesniak Franklin.
Irina, right.
Irina?
Irina.
Oh, Irina.
R-I-N-A. Shabalaba ding dong.
Shabalaba ding dong, exactly. Kenley Collins.
Oh, fuck, he's in All Stars. What is his name? The other Chris March? Not an All Star. Shit.
Ooh.
He was a decoy. Damn it.
All right, so we're back to Sarah.
Oh, it's back to me?
Yep.
Damn. Oh, I can't remember if he actually showed. And that's concerning. And now my mind has emptied. Emptied of people. Oh, Seth Aaron Henderson.
Damn it, that was mine.
That's who I was trying to think
of. Damn it, that was mine.
That's who I was trying to think of.
Still quite a few left.
Yeah. Damn it, I shouldn't have stopped watching when I stopped watching. Where's that one with
right
Thor?
Now, people listening are shouting names at their iPods.
Yeah, honestly, they really are.
Sorry.
Uh-huh. It was Christian Siriano and Jillian whatever and Oh, Rami Cashew.
Nice.
Rami Cashew.
Ooh, nice pull.
Back to
Sarah. Melissa Fleiss.
Damn it. I think I'm out. Anthony Ryan Ald. I don't think that's true. I think that was just All Stars.
I'm sorry. What was that name?
Anthony
Ryan Ald. Yeah.
There's an
done.
Anthony South.
Sarah. Andy South.
Sorry, yeah. Andy South.
No, Ari South.
Althea Harper.
Sure.
Anna so Chi.
Yep.
Anna Young Chi.
Oh,
Carol Whitfield.
Yeah, yeah.
Christopher Paul.
Right.
You said Christopher something else.
You mean Palu?
I said Chris March. He was one of the fourths, I think.
Emilio Sosa.
Emilio. Sure.
Oh, Fabio.
Yeah.
Did somebody say Gretchen?
Yep, that was the first one.
Yeah, Sarah said Gretchen.
Joshua McKinley, I think somebody
of
said
course,
that.
Of course, Drag Brows one.
Oh, yeah.
Laura Bennett.
Laura, that's who I was trying to remember her name.
I officially apologize to Laura Bennett for forgetting her.
Sorry, Mila? Girl. Did somebody
say
Mila?
Mila. Fucking goofy face.
Patricia Michaels. And Stanley Hudson. Yeah.
Stanley.
Seth Aaron
course.
Henderson.
Yes.
And you named the rest.
Said that. Sarah said that one.
Okay, so that point was Sarah's. All right, so that makes it 2-2, correct? With last category coming
I'll play spoiler,
up.
That's fine.
Ooh, exciting. For our last category, saving some sort of tiebreaker situation, your category is shows featured on ABC's original TGIF Friday Night Block.
Oh,
here's where Joe destroys us both.
Further information, that is 1989 to 2000. So there are 29 possible answers here.
What?
That's right. So
okay.
That was Sarah, so we're at Joe first.
Family Matters.
Full House.
Boy Meets World.
Step by Step.
Dinosaurs?
Ooh. Nice.
Just the 10 of us? What?
Nice. Perfect Strangers.
Growing Pains? Oh, I don't have a good feeling about that. I thought so. It was on Tuesdays.
Back to Sarah. TGIF Friday Night Block, 1989 to 2000.
I kind of want to say that robot show. The girl who's the robot, and also
I think that was syndicated.
Part. Alien, I think that was syndicated also. I am shocked that I got as many right as I did. Red Shoe Diaries.
I'm sorry?
Red Shoe Diaries.
Thank you.
Joe, do you want to lay some knowledge on us? Oh, yeah.
I feel like Hanging with Mr. Cooper was one of them.
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
Sabrina the Teenage Witch?
And then either or both of Day by Day or Going Places.
Day by Day is not.
No,
Going Places is.
Yeah.
Do you want the rest of them? Here's one that's surprising and that I don't think anybody would have got. If you managed to get all of them, I think this would be the last show standing of the, thank goodness it's Friday.
Yes.
Friday Night Block.
Yes.
2020.
Oh.
All right.
Okay.
In alphabetical order. Aliens in the Family.
Right.
Baby Talk.
Oh,
Billy.
Yeah.
Brother's Keeper. Camp Wilder. Clueless.
Sure.
Getting By. And Going Places. That should be like one show. Making the Band. Oh, yep, Making the Band.
What?
Mr. Belvedere.
Right.
Muppets Tonight. Odd Man Out. On Our Own. Sister, Sister.
Right.
Step by Step. Teen Angel. What? The Hughleys. Two of a Kind.
Hughleys.
Where I Live. And lastly, You Wish. All right.
Sure did.
So,
do
Joe,
you have a tiebreaker?
I do have a tiebreaker. So, Joe, you're going to have to sit this out.
I'll bow out. Gracefully.
I did
always.
Have a tiebreaker. I set this one aside because it wasn't strictly television, so we're going to play it TV as TV and movie.
Oh.
Okay. All right.
Uh oh.
Our tiebreaker with 44 possible answers, of which I think you'll probably know about three, is actors who have portrayed Sherlock Holmes. We're now, to remind you, TV or movies for okay. this one. And right. Joe got the point, so our next person would have been Tara.
Johnny Lee Miller.
Benedict Cumberbatch.
We're going to need his real name, please.
She might not
Cinnamon
remember.
Toast and Crunch.
Cinnamon Toast and Crunch.
I apologize. Basil Rathbone.
Oh, my.
Well, there's three.
Oh, God. Why can't I remember that kid's name? Just looked this up the other day. Okay, I'm going to take a flyer, and I'm going to crash.
Oh, no.
But here I go with okay. Michael Redgrave.
Michael
Redgrave. So, no.
Oh, congrats, Tara.
You forgot about Robert Downey Jr. That was an easy one.
Oh, Jeremy Brett was the next one I was going to say.
Rupert Everett.
Right. There's
another good Tom Baker, he of Doctor Who fame.
Yeah.
What are
Please don't Rupert list Everett, all 44.
I am not going to. I was just looking for Charlton Heston played Sherlock Holmes. I did Christopher Lee, Christopher Plummer, and others. Well, Frank...
Langella?
Yeah.
Frank Stallone?
No. Oh, and John
Michael
Cleese.
Michael Redgrave should have. He was a fox. I'm just saying.
All right. So, congratulations, Tara.
Yay!
Tara! Tara.
Now my reward is to go write a mistress's post.
That's it for another episode of Extra Hot Great. We played Boardwalk Umpires for the fourth season. I know, I'm sorry. For the fourth season premiere of HBO's drama, we argued whether or not Dave will hate J.J. Abrams' Westworld, and Tara and Sarah asked, who's worse, Dylan McKay or Brandon Walsh? Brackets, Brandon Walsh. Joe successfully put up 6 Feet Under's pilot for the canon. We crowned winners and losers of the week, and Tara was the winner of this week's Game Time. We're on Twitter and Facebook at PreviouslyTV under the EHG hashtag, and on our site, PreviouslyTV, where you can learn more about submitting canons, Game Times, crackpots, and more. Remember,
we're listening.
I am David T. Cole on behalf of Tara Ariano.
Shopping.
Joe Reed.
Don't miss you, Paz de la Huerta.
And Sarah D. Bunting.
Emma, I've come home.
Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time right here on Extra Hot Great.
What am I supposed to do?
You are supposed to leave.